So what we've been doing is going through, a few Sundays of just talking about Lent, because Lent is where we're at. This is actually the fifth Sunday of Lent. Next Sunday is the final sixth Sunday of Lent, but it's also Palm Sunday. So can you believe that we're already into Holy Week? I mean, it's just unreal how fast things are moving. But we've been talking about Lent. We've been trying to reimagine Lent, and this is so critically important. You know, when we are taught rituals, especially as children, and liturgical rituals especially, we learn them in such a way that it's shorn from all of the actual meaning to the symbolism. We just learn to do, but we don't really know why we're doing it. And not only that, when we were taught it, it was pretty negative. Lent was all about deprivation because of penance, because of sin, because of punishment, and so on and so forth. What we're trying to do is to take this into our adulthood and say, okay, if Lent really is about maybe fasting, it is about deprivation, it is about clearing things away, how can we look at that affirmatively? How can we look at that positively? Because Jesus is always positive. He's never coming at things from... Did you notice that? He is never coming at things from the negative. And when people try to bring the negative, he automatically flips it. And so if we're going to follow Lent as Jesus would follow Lent in his 40-ness of his wilderness experience, then it's going to be a positive affirmation. It's going to be about clearing out all the distractions, clearing out the noise that usually keeps us just skittering along the surface of life, just dealing from detail to detail. Right? From stressor to stressor, and never really diving down into what's really important, what's really going on under the surface, as we're going to talk about today, the task within the task. What is that? And so we're looking at Lent in this particular way, and we've had the last three Sundays where we've been talking about this. And I thought maybe it's time for us to take a look at why this is so important. Why is it important for us to approach Lent, as we would say, contemplatively? Approach Lent in such a way that we are letting go of all the thoughts in our head. We're stepping away from that apparatus that is always talking to us and judging and categorizing and comparing and contrasting and all the things that the egoic mind does because of its key to survival. That's what the mind is. It's a tool for survival. It is dealing with the world in a way that everything is competition. And last week we talked about the fact that we don't live in the real world. We live in a world where our thoughts have created the very fabric of the reality that we experience. So the reality that we believe is a reality that we endure. Think about that. Our thoughts create our reality. Anything that comes to us from the outside, once it passes through the filter of our mind, thank you, dear, then we've already changed it. It's only comporting to what we think we already know how to do. And since the mind is geared to survival, everything is negative. Everything is dealing with the anxieties and the stressors of trying to get the next advantage, get to the next place. We create a world that we feel that we need to control. And that creates so much of the stress that we feel all the time. If we were able to break through all of that, if we were able to break through and see the world as it really is, just for a moment, and then more and more realize that we can live there, we can go there, we can step aside from this constant torrent of thoughts and live the life that Jesus calls kingdom, what would that look like in an actual person if we really broke through and saw the world as it is? As I was thinking about this, a movie came to mind. Shocker, right? A movie's always coming to mind, or a song or something. Y'all remember the movie Chariots of Fire? Yes. It's getting to be quite old now. I think it was 1981, Chariots of Fire. But if you remember the movie, it's actually one of the top British films of all time. I think it's number 10 or something in their top 100. So it's very well regarded. But if you think about Chariots of Fire, it's a story of the run-up to the 1924 Paris Olympics, the Summer Games. Now just, again, stop for a second. 1924, that's exactly 100 years ago. Is that amazing to think? 2024, we are 100 years from that. Almost every person on the planet at that time, the population of the world was estimated to be around 2 billion in 1924. You know how many people are alive today over the age of 100? About 770,000 out of 2 billion. I mean, you know, as I was thinking about the movie and I was watching clips from the movie again to refresh myself, everyone who had anything to do with this real story is gone. You know, I think it's a healthy thing. It sounds morbid on the face of it, but I think it's a healthy thing for us to remind ourselves that in 100 years, you know, is anyone even going to remember our name? All these things that we skitter around and we focus on and we're trying so hard to do and we're trying to find meaning and purpose in what we accomplish and what we build and we want to leave some kind of legacy and we want to be remembered. And in 100 years, two generations, is anyone really going to remember our name? Is anybody going to care? So if that is the case for the vast majority of us, then where is the meaning in life? See, this is the key. When we move from the first to the second halves of life, the sense of meaning changes. And this is what Jesus is talking about. In this movie, the movie is in the run-up to the Olympics. It's the story and the contrast between two runners. One is Harold Abrams, and he was a British Jew. And the other was Eric Liddell, and he was a Scottish Christian. And Harold Abrahams was a character who was very traumatized. He was very bitter over the prejudice that he faced in England in the 20s as a Jew. And it was very real, and he was cut out of a lot of things. And that really affected him. It traumatized him. And so his running was actually an act of revenge. He wanted to win and prove himself better than all of those other Brits who had so demeaned him as a Jew. And as you watch his character through this movie, he's like a balled fist. He's always tight. He's always anxious. He's driven. And he's very insecure about his running. And he runs to win. Everything is about running to win. Winning is everything because this is what he's focused on. But it puts him into a dilemma. At one point in the movie, he says, you know, if I can't win, I won't run. And, of course, the rejoinder to that is if you don't run, you can't win, you know. But that's not the way he sees it. In his drive for this particular outcome, he can't see anything else. And so he hires a professional trainer to train him for the Olympics, and he has to keep that on the down low as he's preparing for the Olympics. And then we take a look at Eric Liddell on the other side. Eric Liddell was born in China to Scottish missionary parents. And he was born there as they were working in the field. He's a staunch Christian. And he is also preparing for his own ministry. He's preparing to become a minister. He's preparing to do his own missionary work. But at the same time, he's an actually very famous runner, an athlete in Britain at the time. Even more famous as a rugby star. And so he's got that going for him too. And he's training for the Olympics. And in the course of this training for the Olympics and more of the attention and the focus going on the games and his running, he has a run-in in one scene with his sister Jenny. And his sister is younger than him, and they were both raised the same way. And she is just tearing into him. She's just taking him to task because he is abandoning his mission, right? He is neglecting his studies. He has taken time off from school. He has taken time off from the mission field in order to do this. And she just goes at him. And he's just kind of standing there taking it as she is pounding on him verbally. And then finally he says this to her. He says, Jenny, I believe God made me for a purpose, for China. But he also made me fast. That's the way he said it, fast. He also made me fast. And when I run, I feel his pleasure. To give it up would be to hold him in contempt. To win is to honor him. Oh, it was such a transitional moment in the film. When I run, I feel God's pleasure. Contrast that to Harold Abrahams and the reason that he is running as an act of revenge. Ironically, Eric Liddell was said to be the ugliest runner to ever win the Olympics. Now, he was a good-looking guy. It wasn't about his face. It was about his running style. He ran, and when he got into a flat-out sprint, his head would go back, his mouth would be open, and his eyes would be still looking at the finish line down like this, and he'd be clawing at the air. This is the way he ran. It was the weirdest form you had ever seen, but man, he could smoke. It was unbelievable, but the ugliest runner to ever run the Olympics. When he ran the Glasgow 440, it was sometime before the Olympics came, and he was far back in the field, and entering the last lap, but the announcer who was announcing and said, hey, you know, you can't count him out because his head no back yet. In that last heat, he just threw his head back and he won that race in just that last spurt. But that was the kind of runner he was. It wasn't something that was pretty. It wasn't cultured. It wasn't refined. He was, God made him fast, you know? It's that kind of thing. In the movie, the 100 meters race is set in the Olympics for on a Sunday morning, and he refuses to run because it's Sunday. And imagine the pressure that is on him. I mean, he is representing England here, and he is England's best hope. Harold Abrahams is also, you know, a very fast runner, but he has got all this pressure on him, and he's called in, you know, among all the elders and all these statesmen and whatnot, and he refuses, I will not run. They find a compromise, though. He won't run the 100, but he wasn't scheduled to run the 400. And so they put him on the 400, which is a few days later, which allows Harold Abrahams to win the 100 that he may not have won if he was competing with Liddell. But he wins the 100. And when we get to the 400-meter race, and you watch him on the field, on the track, he's got a sports coat on over his running shorts and T-shirts. Yes, they ran in T-shirts back then. He's got a sports coat over, and he's got this broad smile on his face, and he's just kind of working the field. He's walking up to all of the other runners and introducing himself and shaking their hands, wishing them good luck. And the runners are just kind of looking at him like, who the heck are you, you know? He is completely unconcerned. He is completely himself. He is completely relaxed. In an Olympic race, when he's representing his country and so much hope is being put on him by his countrymen and those politicians who had scolded him. And this is who he is, just concerned with his competitors, wishing them luck. Liddell, pitted between Abrahams and his sister Jenny, is really showing the contrast here that we're talking about. Both of those other characters, Abrahams and Jenny, were driven, they were anxious, they were tight, you know, tightly wound. They were basically the same person, but with different agendas, different sides of the fence, but the same person. Now, after the Olympics, he wins the 400. After the Olympics, he finishes school, and he goes back to China as a missionary, and he spends the next 20 years there. And he died there in China in 1945 in a Japanese internment camp. He was only 43 years old. I wanted to read something for you about him, because we can say, okay, this is just a movie, and we know what movies do. And the movie did take some historical liberties. But it seems to me that they really captured the man. Because just listen to this. While he is best known for athletics, Liddell's true passion was found in his missionary work. Liddell used his athletic experience to train boys in a number of different sports. One of his many responsibilities was that of a superintendent of the Sunday school at Union Church, where his father was pastor. During his first furlough from missionary work in 1932, he was ordained a minister of religion. On his return to China, he married Florence Mackenzie of Canadian missionary parentage in Tianjin in 1934. The couple had three daughters, the last of whom he would not live to see. In 1941, life in China had become so dangerous because of Japanese aggression during World War II that the British government advised British nationals to leave. Florence, who was pregnant, and the children left for Canada to stay with her family. When Liddell accepted a position at a rural mission station in Xiaojiang, which served the poor. He joined his brother Rob, who was a doctor there. The station was severely short of help, and the missionaries there were exhausted. A constant stream of locals came at all hours for medical treatment. Liddell arrived at the station in time to relieve his brother, who was ill and needed to go on furlough. Liddell suffered many hardships himself at the mission. As fighting between the Chinese 8th Route Army and invading Japanese reached Shaojing, the Japanese took over the mission station, and Liddell returned to Tianjin. In 1943, he was interned at the Weixin internment camp. Liddell became a leader and organizer at the camp, but food, medicine, and other supplies were scarce. There were many cliques in the camp, and when some rich businessmen managed to smuggle in some eggs, Liddell shamed them into sharing them, while fellow missionaries formed cliques, moralized, and acted selfishly. Liddell busied himself by helping the elderly, teaching Bible classes at the camp school, arranging games, and teaching science to the children, who referred to him as Uncle Eric. It was also claimed that one Sunday, Liddell refereed a hockey match to stop fighting amongst the players, as he was trusted not to take sides. One of his fellow internees later wrote a book about his experiences in the camp and described Liddell as the finest Christian gentleman it has been my pleasure to meet. In all the time in the camp, I never heard him say a bad word about anybody. Langdon Gilkey, who also survived the camp and became a prominent theologian in his native America, said of Liddell, "Often in an evening I would see him bent over a chessboard or a model boat or directing some sort of square dance, absorbed, weary, and interested, pouring all of himself into his effort to capture the imagination of these penned-up youths. He was overflowing with good humor and love for life, and with enthusiasm and charm. It is rare indeed that a person has the good fortune to meet a saint, but he came as close to it as anyone I have ever known." In his last letter to his wife, written on the day he died, Liddell wrote of suffering a nervous breakdown due to overwork. He actually had an inoperable brain tumor. Overwork and malnourishment may have hastened his death. Liddell died on 21 February 1945, 5 months before liberation. Langdon Gilkey later wrote, "The entire camp, especially its youth, was stunned for days. So great was the vacuum that Eric's death had left." According to a fellow missionary, Liddell's last words were, "It's complete surrender," in reference to how he had given his life to God. Wow. How did he do that? How does a person do that under those conditions, both as an Olympic athlete and as a missionary in China? How did Liddell manage to remain staunchly in the real world? The real world, you know? Escape his own thought world. Escape his own egoic thought life. And really live in the real world. To be that present. To be that celebratory of life. To see the opportunity and the goodness even in the most difficult situations. Liddell was able to break through the world that our minds create, that are all about survival, all about competition, all about gaining advantage, and see what was really going on. Liddell's genius, I think, in the pressure of the race that the movie depicts, his concern for his competitors, his presence to his competitors, displaced his own fear, displaced his own concern for himself, displaced his concern for the outcome of the race. That didn't matter. At that moment, it seems to me, he was just completely connected to all of those other runners from all over the world and just reveling in the fact that he got to stand there on that field with them and be a part of their lives. He wasn't thinking about the race yet. He would think about the race when he got to the starting blocks and took his sport coat off. But that moment was a pure presence in what he was doing. And in the cruel conditions of the internment camp, his concern for the prisoners, his concern for the children especially, displaced his fear and his concern for himself, for his tumor, for his health and well-being. Even apparently is concerned for his family at the moment. They were safe, but he was apart from them. He focused exactly where he was. He saw what the moment actually contained, and not just the inside of his own eyelids. This is huge. Now, speaking for myself, I'm much more Abrahams than Liddell. I got to tell you, especially in my 20s. This is the thing that just blows me away. Remember, Liddell was 22 when he ran that race in those 24 Olympics. He was 22. Think about where you were when you were 22. When I think about where I was when I was 22, I literally cringe. I was so ridiculously unaware of everything. I was so caught up in all my, and I was a ball of confusion and anxiety. I was driven to try to prove something that I didn't even know what I was proving. I mean, that's who I was. At 22, he was this person? How in the world does that even happen? I believe that Liddell somehow was able to clear his distractions. Who knows what that was? Yeah, we can say he was an old soul, but that's too easy. There was something that he did early on in his life that allowed him to clear out all the stuff. Maybe well taught by his parents. Who knows what the combination was? His sister didn't go where he went, right? Raised in the same home. But he was able to go to a place where I think he realized two huge insights. And the first insight was this idea of the task within the task. And Richard Rohr is huge on this. Just read this definition of the task within the task, or listen to this. I'll read, you listen, all right? He says, religion and various models of human development seem to suggest that there are two major tasks for each human life. The first task is to build a strong container or identity. The second is to find the contents that the container was meant to hold. The first task we take for granted as the very purpose of life. This does not mean we do it well, but because we're so focused on it, we may not even attempt the second task. During the first half of life, we invest so much of our blood and sweat, eggs and sperm, tears and years, that we often cannot imagine that there is a second task or that anything more could be expected of us. It takes much longer to discover the task within the task, as I like to call it. What we're really doing when we are doing what we are doing. What we're really doing when we're doing what we're doing. Now think about Liddell. He was running. He was teaching. He was playing chess and making model boats with the kids at the camp, right? He was leading square dances. That was all the stuff he was doing. But what was the task within the task? Where was he focused? It wasn't just playing chess and it wasn't just square dancing. He was focused on that much deeper meaning of the absolute connection that helps everyone to be able to see God's presence in the moment as clearly as he did. That was what he was doing as he was doing all that other stuff, whether he was running or whether he was missionizing. It didn't matter to him. He was focused on the deeper task, even as he paid attention to the surface details. We had to do the wanting and the trying and the achieving and the self-promoting and the accomplishing. In the second half of life, we start to understand that life is not only about doing, it's about being. Most often we don't pay attention to this inner task until we have had some kind of fall or failure in our outer tasks. If the agenda of the first half of life is social, meeting the demands and expectations our circumstances ask of us, then the questions of the second half of life are spiritual, addressing the larger issue of meaning. The psychology of the first half of life is driven by the fantasy of acquisition, gaining ego strength to deal with separation, separating from the overt domination of parents, acquiring a standing in the world. But then the second half of life asks of us and ultimately demands relinquishment. Relinquishment of identification with property, roles, status, provisional identities, which will in the end be experienced as a newfound and hitherto unknown abundance. So the first half versus the second half is acquisition versus relinquishment. Now, so many times in here, I've talked about the fact that I believe that God's will is not a what. It's not a detail. It's not something that we can acquire. It's not something that we can accomplish or even do. That's first half of life mentality, first half of life activity. But that God's will is really a how. It's how we do what we do. And that is invested with all the meaning of life. That's second half of life mentality. Now, Abraham's represents the first half of life, right? The race and the winning is everything to him. The winning is everything because the winning is his identity. He needs to see himself as the winner of that race. Jenny is also a first half of life character. And for her, everything is about religious duty. Vastly different activities, vastly different tasks, but the same agenda, the same goal in the end. Liddell represents, of course, second half of life at only age 22, which is just mind-blowing. For him, the race, for him, winning the race is simply feeling God's pleasure as he runs. That's it. Honoring God with a race well run. Religious duty to him is not an obligation. It's also feeling God's pleasure. It's also honoring God. But it's mixed with a passion, a drive to simply leave people better than he found them, wherever he finds them. By seeing through the outer tasks, the first half of life, to the inner task of how God's will operates in our life, Liddell found his second insight. And I think that second insight is radical acceptance. What's radical acceptance? Well, the first half of life is all about change. Change is what we're after in the first half of life. We feel that we're not complete yet. We don't have what we need. We're not maybe good enough. We have to get better. Or maybe we're not recognized for how good we are. And we're certainly not compensated for it, right? We need change. We need to change ourselves, and we need to change our circumstances. Everything that drives us in the first half of life is about change. But the second half of life is about acceptance. Acceptance of each moment as it is, and acceptance of ourselves within the moment, so that the moment becomes just enough. At least on a good day, right? Just enough for us. Even as we keep working for change, we can accept and we can rest in now, in this moment. And then we can learn the ultimate, which is to balance the two. Yes, we have to work for the not yet. We have to work for change, but never at the expense of being able to accept what is right here and right now, this moment. This is what Jesus is all about. Think about the good news. What is the good news of Jesus? The good news of Jesus is that we are already loved. That we are already accepted. There is nothing we can do to change that fact of life. It's written into the universe. It's written into the physical laws. We are already loved and accepted. And that knowing, having that in our back pockets, becomes the launch pad for true transformation. Without that, transformation is all but impossible. To maybe drive the point a little bit further home, do y'all know what CBT is? Cognitive Behavioral Therapy? Okay. So this is a psychological mode of treatment that is basically about change. You know, we're not going to spend a whole lot of time in your past. We're not going to, you know, get inside your head. We're going to teach you ways to be able to change your ingrained thought patterns and behavior patterns. We're going to do that right here and right now, starting in this moment. We're going to work for change. And that's great. But they were finding that it wasn't working really well with difficult diagnoses, especially, I'm going to forget it now. It's not bipolar. It's the other one. Don't you hate when you just forget things? Personality disorder. Yeah. Okay. With those personality disorders, it is so difficult for someone to be able to work with change. Because if you're focused on change, what are you telling a person? You're telling them they're not good enough where they are right now. Marsha Linehan was the one who came up with dialectical behavioral therapy, DBT. And she was someone who was early in her life was diagnosed with schizophrenia. Later, they realized that she had the personality disorder. Why can't I think of that first word? Borderline. Thank you. Borderline. I knew it was a B. Borderline personality disorder. So she's on the borderline between neurosis and psychosis. And Fern found out that's what she actually had. She was working with women who were suicidal, and she was finding that CBT was not getting them anywhere in the population that she was working with. And so she was a Roman Catholic all her life and still is staunch to this day. And she learned meditation and contemplation and contemplative practice from her faith. And she had a kind of a vision. She was in the chapel. She was praying one day, and she said everything just went gold in the room. And at that moment, she realized that she was loved, and she realized that she actually loved herself, even as BPD, even as someone who had suicidal ideation. And she said it was transformative because it was the first time that she realized she loved herself, because now she knew that God loved her. Amazing story. And so what she did was develop DBT, which is working through opposing forces. And the opposing forces are change and acceptance. The two have to be balanced. Even as you're working for change, you need to know you're already acceptable where you are. You are already loved where you are. This is why the good news of Jesus is so vitally important. If we don't know that, if all God is telling us is that we've got to do this, that, and the other in order to be approved by Him, where is the motivation in that? Where is the knowing whether ever you get to that standard anyway? You're on a hamster wheel and you will never get off. But to understand you're already loved, but the work that you do is going to bring you into contact with that love in a deeper and deeper way. This was Marsha Linehan's insight and breakthrough. And radical acceptance is what she called it. And we need to just spend a little bit of time here. Listen to a definition of radical acceptance. Radical acceptance means complete and total acceptance that permeates every part of your being. It's more than an intellectual task. Radical acceptance refers to a specific set of practices and techniques that you can use to get the message through in a completely different way. When you radically accept a painful reality, your thoughts, emotions, physical sensations, and attitude all shift to make room for the true details of what happened to you earlier in your life and for fully experiencing your present reality. This shift creates the opportunity and ability for change. As Carl Rogers once said, the curious paradox is when I accept myself just as I am, then I can change. When I accept myself just as I am, then I can change. Radical acceptance is not just a concept that psychologists talk to each other about. It's a practice that many people are engaged in right now. To practice radical acceptance, we need to accept what is, realize what we can control and what we can't, look at our situation from a non-judgmental perspective, acknowledge the facts of our situation, stop fighting reality, and learn how to live in the present moment despite our pain. So here's the truth. The harder we try to change, the more we stay the same. The mindset of unworth, the mindset of not being good enough, creates a loop in how we move forward. We will never feel that we are good enough if that's the premise from which we are going. We must change in order to be loved, accepted, connected. Then that's a loop that we will always be a part of. Abraham's and Jenny were on that loop. They always needed more. They always demanded more, required more. And the irony is, they will only find enough, even by their own standards, in the acceptance of what is right in front of them right now, at this moment. And to balance that with a work for change in the not yet. How does this play out in Scripture? Take a look at Nehemiah 8, starting at verse 8. Now, to set this up, This is when the a remnant of the Jews have come back from exile in Persia, Babylon. They're there for, you know, 70 years. You know, it's actually a little bit less than that. The way they're measuring them, 70 years is the usual, but it was at least over 50 years that they were there. So that's 2 to 3 generations right there. And they are finally allowed, when a new king comes into power, to go back home, if they wanted to. Most of the Jews stayed in Persia. That's their home now, right? 3 generations in, that's their home. They're all speaking Aramaic by this time. They're not speaking Hebrew anymore. They're speaking Aramaic. And they have a new culture, and they've been exposed to everything new. A lot of them didn't want to go home. There was a remnant, though, of diehards that decided to go back, rebuild the temple, rebuild the city walls of Jerusalem, and start again. And once the temple is rebuilt, this is where Nehemiah is now addressing the people. And they read from the book, from the law of God, translating to give sense so that they understood the reading. See, they could no longer speak the Hebrew that the book was written in. So as they're reading from the Hebrew, someone else had to translate into Aramaic so that they could understand. Then Nehemiah, who was the governor, and Ezra, the priest and scribe, and the Levites who taught the people, said to all the people, "This day is holy to the Lord your God. Do not mourn or weep." For all the people were weeping when they heard the words of the law. And then he said to them, "Go, eat of the fat, drink of the sweet, and send portions to him who has nothing prepared, for this day is holy to our Lord. Do not be grieved, for the joy of the Lord is your strength." And then at verse 11, "So the Levites calmed all the people, saying, 'Be still, for the day is holy. Do not be grieved.' All the people went away to eat, to drink, and to send portions, and to celebrate the great festival, because they understood the words which had been made known to them." What's going on here? Why were the people weeping? They were weeping because the full realization of the catastrophe of their being conquered and exiled and losing the first temple, all due to their own actions of not following the ways of the Lord, allowing themselves to fall into a place of decay where they could be conquered in such a way, was coming back down to them right now at this moment, brought on by their refusal, their own refusal. It is said that the people wept at the sight of the second temple because it was so poor in comparison to the first. They didn't have the resources anymore. They didn't have the ability to build that kind of edifice that they lost. And so here's this little thing, right? The shame, the regret, the trauma, and the unacceptance of the present moment and where they stood. But Nehemiah is saying, don't grieve. Eat and celebrate this day, this now. The joy of the Lord is your strength. Accept that the Lord still loves you. That's the key, isn't it? You're back here in the land. Yeah, we got a lot of work to do. We may never get back to where we were, physically speaking. But the Lord still loves us and still carries us. Accept the Lord's joy in all circumstances. Now take a look at Ecclesiastes, starting in verse 9:7. He's saying exactly the same thing. "Go then, eat your bread in happiness and drink your wine with a cheerful heart. For God has already approved your works." God has already approved your works. "Let your clothes be white all the time, and let not oil be lacking on your head. Enjoy life with the woman whom you love all the days of your fleeting life, which he has given you under the sun. For this is your reward in life, and in your toil which you have labored under the sun." Same message as Nehemiah. God has already accepted and approved your work, your tasks. No matter what you think of your work or your task, God has already approved and accepted them. Celebrate. Accept life as it is right now. And what kind of life is that right now? Take a look. It's called a fleeting life. Now, we understand that in a particular way, but the Hebrew word that is translated as fleeting is havel. Havel is the same word that is translated as vanity, worthlessness, everywhere else in the book of Ecclesiastes. Now, the translator felt that that wasn't the proper translation in this particular case. But it's the same word, and it means the same thing. It means a vapor or a breath. It means emptiness, transitory circumstances, unsatisfactory, pointless, meaningless, worthless. What is the prophet saying? Is he saying life is meaningless? I think so. If we understand it in terms of our accomplishments, in terms of the things that we do as we toil all day long under the sun, the first half of life tasks, the acquisitions that we create, are absolutely meaningless in and of themselves. Until the moment we see through them to the task within the task. Start to look at life with second half of life eyes, to the connection and the unity that is being created as we show up to work and work well and do our jobs as well as we can. Winning a race is meaningless until we feel God's pleasure when we run. Live in the connection and just the joy of being with competitors who are as good as we are. Missionary work, no matter what we accomplish, is meaningless unless or until we fall in love with each face we see as we move through our days. Lent is a time to formally relinquish first half of life attitudes, the first half of life distractions, to clear a space for God to be able to break in through our thought-created walls of our world, ambush us in such a way that we can see what is actually going on here. But even here, in Lent, in this ritual or liturgical practice, anything that we do ritually, anything that we do to deny ourselves, to fast, is also equally meaningless. Vanity, chasing after the wind, as the prophet would say. Until, take a look what Jesus says at Matthew 6, starting at verse 16. Whenever you fast, do not put on a gloomy face as the hypocrites do, for they neglect their appearance so that they will be noticed by men when they are fasting. Truly I say to you, they have their reward in full. But you, when you fast, anoint your head and wash your face so that your fasting will not be noticed by men, but by your Father who is in secret. And your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. Not in heaven, not later, but with the sense of connection and feeling God's pleasure as you're doing what you're doing. That's the reward. It's right here. It's right now. It's simultaneous. Lenten fasting, any denial, any ritual or spiritual task is meaningless until the moment it's not a task anymore. It's not denial or restriction or obligation anymore. It's not a means to an outcome or another end anymore. Until the moment we feel God's pleasure in the running, we are still just doing things that have no inherent meaning, and the meaning has not connected with us. That connection is the task within, and that's what means everything. How did Liddell do it? I don't know, at age 22. You know, at age 42, I first got my first inklings. He had 20 years that he could live this thing. He only lived till 43. That's when I was just starting to wake up, right? To see through the task, to the task within, allows the radical acceptance of what is now, what is right now. And then we start to realize that having or having not is what is really meaningless. It's not about accomplishments. All accomplishments are equally meaningless. And I'll tell you what, at my age, to start to realize that all the things that I have done that I might be proud of, and all the things that I have not done that I still am yearning for, it doesn't matter. Everything is equal. You become president of the United States, or you're custodian at a high school. In God's eyes, it's equal. It doesn't matter. How hard is that? To break through the world that our minds have created for us, where everything is in hierarchy. Everything is telling us how good we are, how much we're being approved or being loved. But we already have that. And the things that we do, if they're coming out of that love, that's feeling God's pleasure as you run. That's all we need. That's all there is. Everything else that we accomplish ends at the headstone. It doesn't go any further. We have to understand this. This is what the prophet is saying in Ecclesiastes. He's come to that point. He realized it's all vanity. It's all the chasing after the wind. And yet, here is this thread of nowness that connects it all and reinfuses meaning into everything that we do. Our accomplishments end at the headstone, but what we learn through having done what we do. And if we have been perseverant, if we have shown up every day and we've continued to be faithful in the work that we do, what we learn of God's reality, what we learn of the love that is at the source of all of this, that is the meaning that is eternal. In having not, if we are doing that this Lent as a process of clearing out, then when all that we have required is gone, all that's left is what is true, what is meaningful. And when we can accept that, be okay with that, smile through that, have a sport coat over our running shirts, and just greet everybody as if you're just out for a Sunday stroll instead of the race of your life, then we can feel God's pleasure. Let's pray. Father, we want to feel your pleasure. It's that simple. But we've got these big heads in the way. Help us to deflate those. Help us to continue to chip away, even cognitively, at what we hold so dear in our minds. But even more importantly, help us to continue to practice unguarded moments. Moments where we just get lost in the moment. In the prayer, in the centering prayer, in the meditation, in the doing of whatever we do. To get lost enough that you can break in and show us there's another there that we haven't considered. And that we can fall in love with that there. And then it becomes a new motivation, a new driving force in our life that has nothing to do with acquisition, only the continual relinquishment of decreasing as you increase in our lives. Thank you, Lord. Never let us forget we can only love because you loved us first. In Jesus' name, amen. Let's all stand.